The Unlovely Truth discusses subjects that may be upsetting to young or sensitive listeners. Please use discretion. From the beginning, I wanted this podcast to be different from other true crime podcasts. I wanted to share with my listeners, my guests' valuable insights, and show the hope that even in violent, unfair circumstances, God can be found. In the last 12 episodes, we've looked at cases presented in 8 different books with 9 fantastic guests, people who I believe God has used to make a positive difference in many people's lives. These episodes have more in common than just being about finding a way to lean on faith to make sense of terrible tragedies. I could see that there were red flags that repeated through each story and heroes hiding in plain sight. But most of all, there was God. So let's take a look at some of the best parts of the last 12 episodes. Welcome to episode 13 of The Unlovely Truth. We started off with one of my favorite books of all time, Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. It is written by a man not only determined to fight for justice, but also savvy enough to know that to really affect large-scale change, he needs to make us feel the same way. Reading the chapters where he describes visiting his clients in prison, I knew that Tina Solomon would be the perfect guest for this first episode. I wanted to know about the women that she works with through her ministry, Holding Out Hope.
Tell me what these women typically have in common. Obviously, they're all individuals. They all have their own story. But is there something that, you know, we can share with our listeners and they can be on the watch for women in their lives, things that they have in common that may lead them down a path that they don't want to go?
You know, that is such a great question, Lori. I think when I look at teenagers, I've often said some students are so close from going from the school bus to the prison bus. And you have many dynamics, many of these women, and I'm just saying a blanket statement. It's not true of each individual, but blanket statement. There's a lot of brokenness. They often come from homes where we see that crime is repeated generation by generation, often in our society. Right now, I have 2 generations in my choir. I have a mother and I have a daughter. They are both charged partners. They both committed a crime together. But in years past, maybe I want to say 7 years ago, I had a grandmother, a mother, and a daughter, 3 generations in my choir. And they also were charged partners and had done something very heinous together. And in one fell swoop, all of those people were gone, and 3 young children were left without a mother or a father, because the father was murdered. And I see a commonality in you have a lot of drugs that happen that infest families. And many times, poverty leads to a lot of very disastrous choices just to survive.
Tina's amazing work caught the attention of a listener in Indiana who messaged me about episode 1. Karen Browning and her family founded Waymaker Ministries Incorporated to reach out to residents of their county jail. She shared that, like Tina, she sees how generational poverty and addiction feed incarceration rates. She has many volunteers who give not only their time and effort, but love to these people who really need it. Keep up the great work, everyone at Waymaker Ministries. Our second episode was very uncomfortable for many listeners, but for me, it highlighted one of those unlovely truths that I wanted to discuss. In light of the recent sex scandals in the Catholic Church and Southern Baptist Convention, among others, Pastor Josh Brooker and I talked about the need to bring to light the fact that this does happen and what people can do about it.
But there has to be accountability.
100%. And I would also add to that, by you speaking up and you saying something and you going to the authorities, you're preventing any future abuse from happening to someone else besides you. So
oh, exactly.
It's an act of courage. It's an act of bravery. It's actually an act of love to do that.
Right. You're protecting people that you haven't met, that you don't even know, but it's just crucial. You'll never know what a great impact you have by saying this has to stop now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the journey of recovery is a slow meandering process. I wish I could say that there's a magic pill or a silver bullet, but anyone that's walked through that, and I've spoken with them about it, they say that it's slow and it's meandering, but the Lord is good and His grace is there. And He's there as the wonderful counselor, as His word says.
Here's a topic that can be kind of tricky is forgiveness. Hmm. I know, you know, I have a hard time forgiving people when they cut me off in traffic. So I can't imagine having to find the strength of conviction to be able to forgive someone that has done such an unspeakable act. But as believers, we're called to do that. How do you start that journey? Because I'm sure that also is a journey. It's not just, oh, I forgive you and things are all better. That has to be a process.
Absolutely. From those who I've spoke with that have walked through things like this, I think the ones that have implemented that forgiveness in their life and seen hope and freedom from resentment and bitterness and unforgiveness, they'll all tell you the same thing, and it's that forgiveness is a choice. And usually it's a daily choice. It's the decision that someone makes every single day to not allow what has happened to them and the sins of someone else to control them for the rest of their lives. And so it's a daily decision to bring that baggage, to bring that hurt, to bring that pain before the Lord and choose to release that person and allow God to be the judge of that person.
I think you make a great point when you say that so much of it is about not letting that person continue to control and hurt you. Because I think a lot of us, when we think of forgiveness, we almost think that we're saying what happened, you know, well, that's okay.
Right.
And that's not it at all.
No, it's not. It's not a condoning of what happened to us. But what it is saying is it's saying that what has happened to me does not define my story for the rest of my life. And it does not get to define the story for the rest of my life. And it's actually turning that person over to let God be the judge of what happens to that person instead of for ourselves to be the judge.
One of my listeners reached out after hearing this episode to say that Josh's explanation of forgiveness had changed her perspective, and she was grateful for that. And that is the kind of feedback that I love to get. Episode 3 featured Texas PI Mark Gillespie talking with me about how human traffickers lure in their targets and what we can do to be more aware to protect people that we love and those in our circle of influence.
How are they lured in? Because obviously people don't come up and say, hey, I'd like for you to be a prostitute in my organization here. How do they get these people brought into this world?
Well, that's a very good question, and there are many answers to that. You've got different forms of luring people, luring kids into human trafficking, sex trafficking. You know, it can go from starting with your young child who has a laptop or a cell phone, has access to the internet. Where children play, predators prey. It can be on a playground. It can be in your neighborhood. It can be in your daycare. It can be in your schools. There are people that are watching our children, and these predators are decades older than the children. So what happens is you've heard the term grooming. Grooming is essential. Grooming is a critical aspect of and characteristic of the sexual exploitation of children. It's a way that predators lure their prey into their world. And it doesn't happen overnight. It happens with one little click of a computer, a like on a Facebook, or a short little conversation. And then it's a one innocent little click on a computer, on a cell phone. Next thing you know, they're talking, they're exchanging information. The predator is building trust. You know, they're having a lot of texting interaction. And that can go over an extended period of time. Next thing you know, pictures are being sent. You know, maybe not crude pictures at first, but it generally goes in that direction. And then, you know, a lot of times, and we always say, how does this happen? I mean, how does someone get in, you know, to begin in such an innocent fashion, now is involved in terrible relationship online? How does that happen? Well, it happens because the predator, you know, shows affection, shows compassion, shows appreciation, shows trust, shows caring, you know, all the good things that we want to view in people. It's like a bait on a hook, and that fish is always going after that bait because it's something that will make them happy.
Well, what can we do? What can listeners do, the average person, to keep an eye out for the people in our circle of influence, you know, vulnerable teenagers that are looking for affection for maybe a much older man, that kind of thing? Or like you mentioned, even younger children.
It all starts in the home.
So many cases really do start in the home, because statistics tell us that the people most likely to be involved in violence against a victim is someone that victim knows well. But that wasn't the case in our next two stories. Police thought Ashley Ellerin's death at first looked like it may have been tied to her work as a stripper and escort, but years later it was found out to be the work of a serial killer. It was easy to assume that it had to have been the lifestyle, because we all know what strippers are like, don't we? I asked my friend Lori Prather, who has ministered to workers at a strip club, to see what she had learned about the lives of the women she met.
So I know that when you spoke with these women, you learned a lot about them. Describe one of them to us, not, you know, in any great detail so we'd know who it is, but just a general idea of what her life is like.
Absolutely. And I will start with real quickly, the second time I went, or the third time, I finally started to figure out their schedule, like when they came in to get ready and when the club opened. And by the way, the club, you didn't have to pay to get in until 5 o'clock, which is how I finally realized that's why I could just walk in and nobody cared that I was there. And so about 3 weeks in, one of the girls, and she's going to be the one I described because she is certainly the one that I probably connected with the most, and she was most consistently there. It was just her and I in the room, and she got really quiet. And she finally said, "Why do you do this? Why do you bring these treats?" And I said, "Oh, I just felt called to come and love on you. This just seems like a hard job, and I live in the neighborhood. And so I just wanted to bring something that kind of brightens your week." And she kind of nodded her head and she said, "Huh." Because the girls and I were talking, and we think maybe you hate strippers and you're putting stuff in the food.
Of course.
Oh my gosh, Rick. And she kind of laughed, like one of those, like, "I'm only half kidding. I'm going to see how you respond to that."
Right.
And of course, I was like, no, I just love you. But you know what I love about that is I came home and I was sharing with my husband, Darren, and he said, "You know what I heard most in that whole conversation?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "She and the girls were talking 3 weeks in, and they're talking about you when you're not there. That's huge. You're stirring, you're causing a scene in a good way, that they're trying to figure out, why does this person want to be nice to us?" And that's, you know, that's going to open the door for conversations. So this girl, she was in her kind of mid to late 30s. She was a mom. Again, because I went during the day, most of the women I encountered were moms, because like every other mom who can, they try to work while their kids are at school. So right. She had three daughters. Her background was that both of her parents were drug addicts. In my experience, that's a very, very common thread that runs through a lot of their upbringings and their childhoods, is that she had two parents, both drug addicts, both in and out of jail throughout her lifetime. So she spent a lot of time being raised by her grandma. She dropped out of school at 15 and never went back. Another common thread that I have found, again, at least with the girls that I experience, most of them had not finished high school because it was hard. Often they just really didn't have the support at home to finish and to feel the need for it and to see that it was important. So she was a mom. I, based on some things she had told me, she is definitely one that I think in her lifetime, stripping may have crossed over at times into even the next level.
We've all seen things start out as something we thought we were in control of. And then somehow things went, as Lori said, to the next level. Our next guest, author, former police detective, and security expert Mike McCarty, shared with us about a man he had come to know after some low-level brushes with the law took a turn when he followed a cold-blooded psychopath down a road that ended with four young men dead, their mother horribly injured, with her life never to be the same. Mike shared with me his thoughts about interviewing Dan Stonebreaker in prison.
In my head, I was thinking that finger pulled the trigger on a shotgun that killed, that was responsible for the death of four boys. And so it was it's a really tough environment.
What did Dan tell you that really you hadn't thought of? What insights did he give into the why?
The why, the one piece of regret that he articulated to me over and over again was why he could not stand up to Drollinger. Why, when they sat in that car and planned those murders, he didn't shoot him. Why he didn't say, kill me, I'm walking away. He just had the regret of, you know, think about being in high school. It's not a decision you're making to kill somebody, but you're going to smoke some pot. You're going to break into a house. You're going to steal a car. It's going along with a group because you don't have the courage to stand up to the group. That's the message that struck me. And I'll tell you, you know, these interviews lasted multiple years before I ever started trying to put a book together. And so there was lots of, you know, interviews with Dan going to Betty. And what struck me was that Dan was at a completely different place than Betty was. I realized, you know, it's a killer and it's a survivor. I'm talking about with peace within their life. He was so much more peaceful in prison than I could ever imagine any human being. But it was the act of God's forgiveness for him. And I get it. Everybody says jailhouse religion. Who hasn't had a conversion for a couple weeks? What I tell people all the time is this man's been in prison since 1977. Jailhouse religion typically is gone at the moment your last opportunity to turn that case back around and get out of prison. He has no motive whatsoever to have any kind of jailhouse religion today, but yet he does. And so I'm not one that's easily fooled. I'm fairly skeptical, to be honest with you. My career is all about making sure, you know, people aren't manipulating, lying. But he's at a completely different place today than where he was in 1977.
Faith certainly helped our next guest from episode 7 deal with a set of circumstances that he was lucky to walk away from with his life. Author J.D. McCabe wrote The Third Gift to tell the story of how, as his marriage was falling apart, so was his physical and mental health. Or so he thought. When he finally learned the truth, he saw how the simple act of counting his blessings helped him survive.
It's hard to, for me anyway, to imagine with the things that you went through, like you said, being manipulated out of your house, having your children kind of turned against you, or at least attempted to have them turned against you, and messing with your work, certainly huge financial burdens. If you could tell our listeners one thing to hold on to if they're experiencing anything similar to this, what would that be?
I would choose two things. First of all, I would say that confide in somebody, whether it's a family, whether it's a friend, find somebody to confide in and to share your challenges with. That was the mistake that I made for the first 6 months of the ordeal, beginning in the spring of 2014, is I confided in nobody. I kept it all to myself, and it ate me alive. The second thing I would say is, in my journey, a lot of cliches came true. And I think the biggest one is we hear it all the time, right? Count your blessings. We hear it. I've heard it since I was a child. And when you absolutely need to sit down and put your head in your hands and count your blessings, it truly does work. I had to focus on not what I had lost, not what I had taken away from me, but what I had and all the blessings that I had. The other thing I would say, the other cliche, is the one of relativity. Everything is relative, right? So when you're in your own little world, you're dealing with tremendous challenges. Just in talking to people, I realized that what I had going on was not nearly half as bad as what other folks had going on. And that was something I shared with my kids as this progressed is, you know, I know you're going through a difficult time. I know you have a lot of unanswered questions, but please do your best to focus on what you do have and all the blessings the good Lord has bestowed on us. Again, I know it sounds cliche, but it is something that helped me to get through was to focus on what I had.
There didn't seem to be a lot of blessings to be counted in Jennings, Louisiana in the mid to late 2000s. The bodies of 8 sex workers were found in the swamps and canals surrounding the town. The police investigation was inept if you were generous, corrupt if you were not. With those cases now long cold, I talked with private investigator Sheila Wysocki about how podcasts can move some of these cases forward.
Very few of them are actual trained investigators that were called in by the family to work a case. Most of them, they saw, and I'm not trying to downplay, a lot of them have had great success and moved things forward, and God bless you for the help that you've given the families. But how did your idea of making a podcast with the sole intent to get people to call in with tips, how has that changed how you work cases?
I think it is the greatest investigative tool known to anybody, and I wish I knew it 10 years ago. I started it to get tips in Lauren Agee's case, and I tell the story because it's so fascinating to me how God worked, and mm-hmm. I call it a God nod because obviously I didn't know what I was doing as a podcaster. I jumped in, and I had help getting it off the ground. It went live at 4:30 on July 26th at the time Lauren's body was found. And I got on a plane at 4:00 and I flew back to Nashville. When I landed, the very first tip had come in from someone I had been trying to get on the record.
I loved what you did by releasing it on the day and the time that Lauren's body was found, because that was such a tribute and showed such respect to the victim. Because if I have any knock on the true crime genre at all, it's glorification of the perpetrators. They can be very interesting in a dark sort of way, trying to figure out, why did you do this? What made you the way that you are? And I do get that. But when we take that to an extreme, you know, you have the groupies that Charles Manson had. You had the same phenomenon with Ted Bundy. I hate for the victims' families to feel like their loved one is the subplot in right. these stories. And you make sure that that doesn't happen.
So I'm very, very clear about my agenda, which is I am not going to speak for the perpetrators. I am speaking for the victim. And that is something I am very clear about. Once I know the case, once I know what happened, and I can potentially prove it in court, you know, of course, evidence in court is a little bit different than evidence, you know, but once I'm solid on what happened, I'm all in for that victim.
And I think you make a great point that there is a very important distinction between what you know to be true and what you can prove is true. And that's why people coming forward is so important.
It's refreshing to see a small trend in the various forms of true crime media where victims are getting their stories told, rather than the main focus being on the offenders. That angle certainly drew me to the book, The Hot One. And even though I'd already covered Ashley's case, I knew I couldn't pass up the opportunity to speak with her friend and the author of The Hot One, Carolyn Murnick. We talked about how strange it seemed to her that even in stories where women are the victims, is usually men who are the stars in their stories.
It wasn't until I, got a little bit more mature and sort of started understanding perhaps feminism that I realized, most of these stories are focused on men. And if it's not the killer, it's the male detective. And they are always the person that's centered in the story. And we think that, this is about what happened to this woman, but mostly she's just used as a plot point or a body. And she's often, heavily sexualized and objectified. And it's inside the mind of the killer that we're really focusing on. And that's what's hooking people. And obviously that felt totally wrong and inappropriate to me. And as I've gotten older and as my book is out in the world and we're kind of inundated with these hunt for a killer type of stories, that it's become really even more outrageous to me. And I like to take every chance that I can get to talk about how much we need more nuanced, complex ways of crime storytelling. And there's just too much out there that is formulaic, which is not really connecting with the reader in the way that any story of loss and of crime and of violence should. We're missing the point of what these stories are about when we're focusing on the killer and the kind of male detectives.
And I love that you bring up that point, because one of the things that I had hoped to do by starting my podcast was, find a positive angle to take these stories and, like you said, tell the story of the victims and help people that are reading the story maybe see red flags, if not in their own lives, but in the lives of people around them. And, really give people an outlet to say, let's have an uncomfortable conversation with a person that we see maybe having, not to victim blame, but someone that is maybe making some choices that might put them a little bit at risk or might get them in the company of people that don't have their best interest at heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there's been a lot of writing in line with this true crime boom of why is it exactly that the big audience for these stories is women when women are the ones being victimized? And so what is it that women are getting out of consuming these stories? And I've talked about this with a lot of women and authors and sort of true crime enthusiasts. And a lot of people say in some ways we're subconsciously kind of fact finding and figuring out ways to stay safe in the world by learning about these stories. If we can,
right.
It allows you to, cause as women in the world, we have to have like the spidey sense of danger around us and potential risks, and that these stories are helping us, are like parables about, what could happen to us potentially. And so that's something that I think a lot of women are finding really important. And also it's a way for us to process our fears about, these threats that are going on in the world.
Learning how to stay safe and process our fears are no doubt two of the biggest reasons true crime fans are so interested in these stories. I believe another is to keep these terrible acts from happening again if we can. To do that, we have to work together. My guest for episodes 11 and 12, Jill McCracken, had a lot to share about how working together can really affect people all over the world.
During this conflict, New Jersey at Fort Dix had taken in 5,000 Kosovar Albanian refugees. So I networked around, which is, this is still, the year 2000. So the internet is kind of working, but not like we have today, believe me. And I got in touch with a young man named Gentian, and he had now gone from Fort Dix to Staten Island, where he had some cousins. And he agreed to practice with me. So we were on the phone, landlines, not cell phones. And he would laugh with me. I'd say things like, the bathroom's on fire, instead of where's the bathroom. And there's certain words you can't say, syllables and put together and things. So we'd laugh. And when it got to the point where I was like, really, I'm leaving and packing bags, he says, you're really going to do this? And I said, yes. And he says, then you have to find my mother. And all of a sudden things got very serious, but I'm like, what? You have to find my mother. The last thing she heard, I was running, Serbian troops were chasing me. She doesn't know if I'm dead or alive. You have to find my mother. And now I'm blinking my eyes 100 times a minute and saying, Gentian, how am I going to find your mother? I don't know where I'm going to be. How am I going to do this? And he says, well, I know you're going to be in the capital, Pristina, and you will find my best friend, Fitim Zara, and he will take you to Jakova. And he will take you to my mother, and you will find my mother, and you will tell her I'm alive. And I said, Fitim Zara, Fitim Zara. I'm like, Jakob is a city. It's a town. It's a little town. It's a village. I'm sure. I said, well, all right, sure. I'm going to find Fitim and I'm going to find your mother. He says, when we have to meet, because I have some things you have to give my mother for me. So I go to Staten Island. I meet Gentian. He gives me a pair of shoes and black hair dye. And I'm like, Gentian, you're such a sweet, but you're such a guy. I said, come here. And I take his photograph. A mother is going to want a photograph. I mean, yes, your mother might be a little on the vain side. I mean, we all get our hair done and all, but she's going to want a photograph. So I agree to do this thing. And to show you how close it was, I literally had the photograph. This is old-fashioned film developed in Jerusalem. That's how closely timed this was. So the whole time that I'm now in Jerusalem studying at Yad Vashem with the Holocaust teachers and from all over the world, in the back of my mind, I'm really nervous. I'm like, how am I going to find this woman? How am I going to find Fitim? So we're there about 3.5 weeks now, and the Kosovo part is coming up, and we had a day off, and we're touristing around. I think we were at King David's Tower, and we stop in this little nothing of a place to have some beer and hummus and pita bread. And one of the Austrian teachers says to me, Jill, I heard you're doing something crazy. You're going to Kosovo next week. And I said, yes, I am going to Kosovo next week. And I feel this tap on my shoulder, and I look over, and there's an Israeli couple, Mr. and Mrs. sitting next to me. And they said, I'm sorry, we don't mean to interrupt. Did you just say you were going to Kosovo? And I said, yes, next week I'm going. We're going to Kosovo. Now, Lori, this is not the tourist capital, okay? I'm not kidding you. This is military occupation. So my jaw drops and I'm like, oh my gosh. I said, I'm going to study, ethnic cleansing. Why are you going to Kosovo? So they say to me, well, Israel will do whatever is necessary to stop ethnic cleansing and genocide. We have a history. It is our duty to do this. I said, well, of course. And they said, and most of the refugees that were coming out are Muslims. And if Israel can do something to help Muslims, we're going to do this. So we took in 1,000 refugees, which I was not aware of any of this.
No, and never heard of that either.
Well, Israel did. They took in 1,000 Muslim refugees from Kosovo. And she says, we took in a young man. I'm getting upset again. They took in a young man. And I just knew, Lori, I just looked at them and I said, and his name is Fitim Zara.
Oh my goodness.
And I'm starting to shake. She looked at me. She says, oh my God, you know Fitim. I said, no, I don't. But you do. The Fitim Zara that I have to find so I can bring Gentian's mother this message is the adoptive Israeli son of this couple that's sitting next to me.
See, I don't know how anybody could say there's no God when stuff like that happens.
The unlovely truth is that any one of us could get caught up in a crime of everyday evil. But another truth is that each one of us can be a difference maker that helps someone else avoid or heal from the same thing. Let's go out and be someone who God uses the way we've seen our guests be used. Share your stories of how you've seen someone make a difference using the hashtag UnlovelyTruthTribe. I can't wait to see your posts. The Unlovely Truth is written and produced by me, Lori Morrison. Music is by Neil Cortex, and the artwork is by Shelby Morrison. I want to give a great big thanks to each one of my previous guests who have shared their stories and such wisdom. But my biggest thanks, as always, is to you, the listeners. Please download, share, subscribe, and rate the podcast. You can find it anywhere that your favorite podcasts are found. As always, I look forward to seeing you next time.